Everybody's good with it.
We're ready.
I think you're glad.
Good with it. It's just reinstating some language they meant.
I'd like to bring the meeting back to order, and we were discussing Senator Lurie's Senate File 2754. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we had just finished the discussion and the questions on Article 4, so we'll move on. I'm not sure what article the department wanted to take up next. Article 5, the Jensen Settlement.
There you go. Hey, Madam Chair, members
Mr.
of the
Coleman.
Committee, Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner at DHS for Continuing Care. The next topic we're going to talk about is the Jensen Settlement, Article 5. The department must implement a plan agreed to under the Jensen Settlement for the modernization of Rule 40, which will incorporate many of the recommendations of the Rule 40 Advisory Committee and consultants that have been engaged. Rule 40 governs the use of aversive and deprivation procedures in licensed facilities to serve people with developmental disabilities. Modernization of Rule 40 includes transitioning to current best practices when providing services to all individuals with disabilities. These include the use of positive social and behavioral supports, prohibitions on the use of restraints and seclusion, trauma-informed care, and development of community support plans that are consistent with person-centered planning. As part of the department's oversight and quality assurance responsibilities related to the modernization of Rule 40, DHS must also establish, design, and implement a policy for the quality assurance mechanism, an internal and external review process to identify trends and develop reports and policy recommendations, and protocols for measuring the impact of training and technical assistance. An additional component of the settlement and the proposal is to provide some additional administrative resources for direct care and treatment, state-operated services, to comply with the Jensen Settlement Agreement.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee on that, on the section that we're talking about, the Jensen Settlement compliance? And I don't know, did you wish to testify on this section?
Okay. No, Madam Chair, I was just here if there were questions.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Lurie, any other comments on this section?
Not if there's not questions. I think that was a description of what's in that article.
Okay. Moving on to...
That's all we have.
That's Articles 4 and 5. I don't know what article the department wished to take up next. Not Article 2 yet. We were asked to hold on that.
Six. Senator Lurie, would Article 6 be something we can take up?
Miscellaneous article?
Sure.
I'm sorry. Relating to the Andrew residence?
We're not ready for 2 just yet. I promised we'd hold on that for about 15 minutes. But Article 6 should be short. Can we do Article 6? The miscellaneous article, 2 sections.
Or just the ones we were going to go over.
Just the Andrew.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's sure. Right. Article 6, to reorient members again to the packet that was the materials that were in the packet, there were several items that were blacked out from that. Those are budget only divisions, so they weren't going to get a review in this. Committee Article 6, that the miscellaneous provisions are budget related in our review. So
no, we didn't want a review.
Andrew residence rate adjustment that isn't blacked out.
Blocked out. I mean, that was by the chair.
That's by me. Andrew residence.
Their Andrew residence is here. Is that in Article 6?
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's Section 2 in Article 6, and it is. Okay.
And is that Jane?
I'm Jane Lorenz with the department.
Jane.
Jane Lorenz here.
Okay. Okay. We have Jane Lorenz with DHS to go over the Andrew Residence Rate Adjustment.
Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Jane Lorenz with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm a manager in the Community Living Supports Division, or Community Living Supports Unit, which is part of Transition to Economic Stability Division. Article 6, Section 2, is it?
Yep.
This section codifies payments currently made to Andrew residents, ensuring that the rates are adequate to support this facility. Andrew Residence serves over 200 people with serious and persistent mental illness who also meet the nursing home level of care, and many of whom are under civil commitment. Due to the size of this facility and the population served, the facility is not eligible to receive Medicaid reimbursement from the federal government for most of the people served. A recent review of the rates paid to Andrew residents found that they did not align with requirements in statute. The rates required under the current statute are not sufficient to support the level of services needed to maintain the level of care currently offered. To improve program integrity and ensure that rates continue to fully support the services provided in this unique facility, this section would codify the current rate calculation.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Chair, we have representative from residents to speak briefly for the care provided at this point.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you.
My name is Peter Thielen. I'm the Director of Program Services at Andrew Residence in the Elliott Park neighborhood of downtown Minneapolis. I'd like to share with you a little bit about our organization, who we provide care to, and the importance of those services. We've been in existence for 40 years, providing services exclusively to adults with serious mental illness, primarily adults with schizophrenia. We're a unique organization in that we're licensed both as a nursing facility and as a mental health treatment program. As you heard earlier, most of the clients that we care for are undergoing court-ordered treatment. Many of them are coming from us from the local acute care hospitals, such as Hennepin County Medical Center. A significant number of them are coming to us from the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center, where they've been adjudicated as mentally ill and dangerous. Our clients require a high level of clinical monitoring for their safety and for the community's safety. We're careful to monitor the symptoms of their illness, medication adherence, and overall behavioral stability. We've got a long-standing track record of providing high-quality care. Our survey record, our quality indicator scores, and our resident satisfaction scores are very high and amongst the highest in the state. Last year, it was determined that the rate-setting practice that had been in place since the 90s was not fully clear in statute, and there was a delay in our rate increase. In subsequent meetings, it was determined that our rates would go forward, but that the department would seek clarity in the language, statutory language, this legislative session. Our rates are significantly lower than alternative mental health treatment programs for the population we serve. Our residents are screened prior to admission and on an ongoing basis to make sure that we're an appropriate level of care for them. We are the least restrictive setting for the clients that we serve. These funds keep us at our current rate, and these rates are what is minimally needed to safely provide care to the residents that we serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for testifiers or Senator Laurie? Senator Sharon.
Senator Laurie, this may not have a relationship, but are the 390 Cambridge facility clients that are in community placement at all impacted by this project that's asking for a rate consideration?
I believe the Andrew residents, I don't believe any of the folks from the Jensen settlement reside at the Andrew residence, no.
Thank you.
They're distinct populations.
Any other questions? Seeing no other questions about this section, which section would you like to move to next?
Well, I think we're ready to take up the healthcare payment modernization in Article 2, which would be the hospital rebasing, the FQHC, settle up provisions. We have Nathan Morocco Department. Oh, and it also has the coordination of benefits registry in this article. Yeah.
Thank you. I was away from the table, so I just wanted to just heads up for on the Jensen settlement compliance. I may ask just for one question on that, which is I thought I heard some discussion about some reporting back on some measurements for the implementation of these policies. And when Mr. Coleman come back up later after we're finished with this section, unless he's headed out already, I wondered whether or not one of the things okay. they would – is he still there?
This isn't Commissioner Coleman apparently, but we have Deputy Commissioner Ann Barry says she answers
okay.
some of those.
Do you want to ask him now? I'll ask it, and you can think up your answer while we're hearing on the rest of it. And I was just curious if one of the measurements would be – that they'll be looking at is in relationship to increased staff injury or patient injury, along with taking a look at changes in terms of how we deal with seclusion and restraint and other positive enforcement measures. But that will be measured as we implement the elements of the settlement.
I'm getting a nod that the question has registered, so we'll come back to it and get an answer.
You. Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Rocco. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. There are a couple pieces that are fairly well contained and some pieces that are scattered throughout. So I'm going to start with the two that are relatively contained, the first one being Article 2, Section 1. This is a coordination of benefits registry provision. Essentially, what we're looking to do here is to receive some funding that will allow DHS to contract with the Council of Affordable Quality Healthcare, which is essentially a nonprofit alliance. It's an entity that allows others to understand where coverage may exist elsewhere. And so this is really sort of a coordination or sort of who's primary payer versus secondary payer. So really this provides for the agency sort of a one-stop shop where both the agency and providers as well can understand where other coverage might exist. So, you know, the benefit to the provider is that they get to bill the primary payer the first time, the first go around, you know, rather than having to bill us and then discovering that there may be coverage elsewhere and then having to bill that other entity. So I know this isn't a finance committee, but ultimately this is a cost savings to the program.
Ms. Morocco, what drove that change? What is it that's being resolved here that's a problem?
So, Madam Chair, not necessarily a problem, just looking for another entity that we can work with that will allow us to better identify where other coverage may exist on a national level. And just simply looking for permission to be able to do that. The other provision then that I would direct you to then would be the annual audit reports for disproportionate share hospitals. That's section 12. And this is essentially just requiring the hospitals to provide these reports. It is something that the agency is looking for so that we can get a better sense of those entities that might qualify for the DSH payments. We currently don't get them all today. With that, then, Madam Chair, there is three or four they're scattered throughout the bill. Then are attempting to accomplish really sort of three main goals. The first being the compliance under ICD-10. The requirement by the federal government is that we need to accept and all. Providers need to start billing under this new coding. So the ICD-10 code is what allows us to understand the kinds of services that are being being provided, and then we can then in turn turn around and make payments based on this new coding system.
Before you go there, is there a significant change in the ICD-10 from the ICD-9?
Madam Chair, yes, there is a significant difference between the two in that the ICD-10 coding is much more detailed. It allows us to address different levels of severity, as an example, within the coding structure than what we would have under ICD-9. It's the reason why the federal government has mandated this being effective October 1st of 2014, that all providers do need to start billing under this ICD-10 code for, for better reporting and for better granularity around the kinds of services and the severity of those services that they are providing.
So aside from being able to track that because of the coding, of the more refined coding, is there other implications for us in the state? Are there differentials in rates based on those codes and levels of severity?
Madam Chair, certainly there is, because it is technically a new coding system, to the degree that that the providers do change their coding patterns or behaviors or how they choose to translate between the ICD-9 and ICD-10 codes. I'm not sure that we would have a way to quantify what that would be, but certainly you are going from one system to another, and that may result in some level of change. The idea here being that we are looking to, as best we can, to create a more to try to translate between the ICD-10 and ICD-9 in a way that's relatively similar to what we're doing today.
Well, I just for us to understand, we don't have a choice about this. This is something that we're being required to do, to shift to the most current coding system that's been worked out. This gets renewed and happens periodically. But you're saying that it's more refined, and so they'll use the codes more accurately to describe what they're doing, and you'll be able to track that and see what the practices are and what the trends are. But it's unclear to me. I mean, they're all allowable expenditures. I mean, if you code for it, it's an expenditure. Is that correct? And is there something that follows the refinement of this in terms of being more refined in terms of payment? Do you know the answer to that?
Madam Chair, so the coding is one piece of the payment process. So the first piece that comes in would be the actual ICD-10 codes. Those codes are then evaluated through a grouper system, and that is the second component that's being addressed here, is that we're updating the grouper that is then used to analyze those ICD-10 codes. The grouper change is necessary on two levels, one being because of the new coding system, we need a new grouper that is going to be able to accept and interpret those codes. But I think more importantly, and something that we've worked with the Hospital Association on, is that this is a grouper that does better measure the kinds of patients that we see in the Medicaid population. So this grouper does better measure things like pediatric, births, neonatal care. So the current grouper is really more of a Medicare, or is probably better refined for a Medicare population, which obviously doesn't see a lot of the kinds of services related to children, that this new grouper will better recognize and recognize the kinds of resources that are being attributed to the providers.
The term grouper may be difficult to grasp. It sort of sounds like a fish, quite frankly. But you're talking about how you group, how you put into a category based on certain criteria, various service provisions. Would that be a fair articulation?
Madam Chair, yes, I think that is a fair articulation, and we do actually have somebody here from the department that is an expert in both the coding and the grouper area. If you'd like to get into more of the specifics about how that might work.
Well, it probably is too specific for today, because we will be talking about this more in Senator Lori's committee. But for our committee, I think we need to understand that this. We don't know yet. You have not informed us what these groups will be or what the descriptors will be in order for somebody to be in a certain group. So we don't know how that will impact, along with this other component of ICD-10, what rates will be. Is that correct? And we should have an interest in making certain that how you do the groupers is a fair and balanced set of criteria, because it will impact the financing mechanism. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think I would frame it slightly differently. So okay. The coding itself and the grouper itself are really independent of the results that are obtained through that process. So I think, if I'm understanding where you're getting at, it's sort of what is the net impact to each hospital? The use of the grouper and the coding are simply the tools to analyze the data. Once the data is analyzed and that information is then creates changes from hospital to hospital, it's sort of the result of that will determine obviously which hospital rates change either up or down. But groupers don't necessarily group by hospital. It's really more grouping the claims that are coming in for the patients, and then how that impacts the rates per hospital will then be something that at least today we're not able to answer specifically, but that's what we hope to be able to do in the very, very near term.
Do you anticipate that? I mean, somebody's grouping, doing the process of groupering, right? And we aren't seeing that. We aren't able, and what is the process by which people have input into the process of establishing these groupers, which become a part of a descriptor of a hospital upon which a rate eventually, the rebasing system gets established on?
Sure. Madam Chair, if I could ask the expert from the Department of Human Services, I think they might be able to explain the process about how the grouper interacts with the coding, if that's okay.
Well, I think my question is not so much its interaction as it is whether or not it's visible and transparent to us, so that if we disagree with it, that we have an opportunity to influence before it's implemented. Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, maybe I can offer a little bit of insight as well. So the ICD-10 is a known quantity. It has existed, and it is a federal requirement, as you've mentioned, that claims for inpatient hospital services filed after October 1st of 2014 have to be submitted under the ICD-10. Those need to be, so that's a claim level detail that indicates what happened when a person was at the hospital. Those services need to then be grouped through a grouper process. And that the selection of that grouper, that's a third-party software, basically. And the selection of that grouper was undertaken with the department, my understanding, and the hospital association. So this is actually a third-party vendor that has the APR-DRG grouper that would be used to take the ICD-10, the number of services that came in, and build a claim around it to tag a payment to for that service that was provided at a hospital. And so I don't think there's any controversy or disagreement about whether, ICD-10 changes to it. There's no flexibility there. And I think there's broad agreement that we have the right grouper, that APR-DRG would be the right grouper to use to construct the most complete understanding to build a rate around. Then you need to tag money to it. That's where we get into the real meat of this. So through talking about the ICD-10 and then how you group it, I think there's pretty broad consensus that we're good that far.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on anything that's been said so far? I don't need to dominate. I think this is critical content here for us, and especially for those of you who won't be in finance. If you have questions, now's a good time to ask them. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just to sort of wrap that up, and to your point, Madam Chair, so we're working with the hospital association and with legislators about how we can address perhaps what those results, how we might best manage those results. That might look something like some kind of banding so that there is so that there is not too much of a gain or a loss on either end for a particular provider. There will be separate pools between the critical access hospitals and the rest of the hospitals, so that there would not be money subsidizing between one group or another. And we will really be focusing in on some key services, that being behavioral health, pediatric, trauma, and rural hospitals. So, again, to your point, Madam Chair, I think that's where we'll be working with the legislature and as we work through this process. Those will be, I think, sort of the key areas that we'll be focusing on to as we address some of the outcomes of this process. Finally, Madam Chair, there is one last provision, and this is one that reduces the this has to do with the federally qualified health centers, and we actually have some language pending, so the language that you have here today is not the language that will ultimately be coming forward, but we are working with the FQHCs, and we are in broad agreement about what the language needs to look like, and I think we will have that likely in your hands by Monday.
And that language is attempting to accomplish what outcome?
And so it has to do with the settle up with the federally qualified health centers. Essentially, today, sometimes this process can take upwards of up to 6 years, and so we're just looking to close the window, the gap on the settle up. And so our original language that we had proposed was attempting to do that. The FQHCs weren't happy with the language that we had proposed, but we quickly met with them and, again, have come to a very, very broad agreement about what this language needs to look like. So I'm very confident we'll have something on Monday for this bill.
Okay, good. If I summarize that part of what you're saying to say that this – we've heard some testimony on this before. I can't remember which committee I was in. It might have been Senator Lori, so this committee might not know that the federally qualified health care centers have an issue about delays over disagreements and reimbursements to the Fed that can last long periods of time. And it's really important to them because they are oftentimes running on shoestrings. So to have lots of resources that we really owe them as a state be held away from them for long periods of time, creating a problem for them. So that's the problem that you're trying to fix with this amended language.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct.
Well, and Madam Chair, to be fair to the worry that was expressed as the proposal was initially described was that there are still disagreements over long history of payments to FQHCs, and there was a great concern that those would be closed out without adequate resolution. And they, we prompting had folks sit down and they're, I've checked with both the department and the FQHCs, and they're making significant progress coming to an agreement about how to structure that so that we don't have this long delay into the future either. Still, figure out the past and have a process by which we can close out claims once in 2 years back, just close out that year as we roll forward.
Okay, I know that we haven't had a look at this bill in this policy committee before, so I did agree on this bill to a request by Mary Krinke to speak to the committee. Is she there? You are. I was looking for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And as was mentioned, we did have an opportunity to discuss this at the Finance Committee, but members here may have some questions as well. I agree with everything that Mr. Morocco said, but I do think that he left out a couple pieces of additional information that might be helpful to the members. So in addition to the ICD-10 change, and that is going from 13,000 codes to 68,000 codes, so it is incredibly different. It has not been updated in 30 years, so we are treating new diseases and new technology and things that weren't around 30 years ago, and so it really does need to be done, and it will be good, I think, for our hospitals, but it has to be done. So, and then the grouper that they're referring
to, is that there must be that many codes. I mean, you've got a clinician who's trying to code out the work that they've been doing.
Yes.
So, holy cow, I used to practice yeah. using this thing, and I'm just amazed at the implications of this for the practitioner to code out the variations of the on the theme. So,
And the second piece they were talking about is the grouper, and that does refer to, exactly like you said, Madam Chair, diagnoses-related groups. And so a grouper helps combine those services. And I like to think of it as all the different procedures that go into, like, an appendectomy. So think of it as grouping different procedures together so that then they are in one group of service. And so then we'll get paid based on how those procedures are grouped together.
Do you have concerns about that as an association or its implications as it rolls out here?
Madam Chair, I think the concern is that it is new and it is much more detailed than we've had before. It's going to have four categories of minor, moderate, severe, and extreme. And so every different procedure is going to have a different level within the grouper. I've been with the Hospital Association 12 years, and this is without a doubt one of the most significant changes that we've had to how we are going to be paid. So anxious would maybe be a good word.
As long as you're taking an anti-anxiety medication yes. along with it, huh?
Just a couple more things, if I may mention. So you couple this at the same time with the fact that the department is going to be also implementing budget-neutral rebasing. So that is where, as Senator Laurie said, the real angst is how big is the pie? So while we are very supportive of making the changes to the coding and to the process by which we bill, when the pie stays the same size based on 2002 costs, and now all of a sudden you fast forward to 2012 costs, we are not sure who is going to be getting paid what. So let me repeat that. Right now, the Medicaid payments are based on 2002 costs, and we are fast-forwarding to 2012 costs under budget-neutral rebasing. So we are unsure who the financial net gainers will be and which hospitals will potentially be hurt. And that is what Nathan referred to as perhaps maybe we should look at creating some type of payment bands, and that is not in the bill yet. This is yet to be worked on, where perhaps for the first year, no one hospital could receive payments more than a 5% increase, and no one hospital could receive payments less than a 5% decrease. So we're still kind of working out these details. I don't know if that's the exact number. We're working on that, Madam Chair. So.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. You know that I try to remind everybody that those that have been paid at the higher end of the payment rate, we get concerned about them not having more than a 5% cut. But those at the bottom end who have been going for a lot of years under this model, way underpaid, huge disproportionate range, are being asked to only take a 5% increase. So, you know, I don't know where that's going, but Senator Laurie, maybe you'd like to say something about that. And then, Ms. Krinke, you talked also about DSH payments. I wondered yes. if you needed to alert us to yes. what we should be thinking about there.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The one other piece I wanted to mention that was not in the presentation so far, I would really like to draw everyone's attention to the repealer section. You always have to look at the repealer sections. And the repealer section of this proposal repeals the small rural add-on. It repeals the 16 DRG add-on. It repeals DISH payments for critical access hospitals. And so this is part of the anxiety and moving pieces. Now, I know the department is trying to get at a more simplified rate structure, which in the long run will probably be a good thing. But as we move to a more simplified rate structure, there are these current add-on payments that do benefit some of our hospitals. So this is the work that we are doing now as we try to analyze these proposals. But I know when legislators look at this language, they may not realize how many provisions are in this repealer section of this proposal.
And those components, Ms. Krenke, that are being repealed, they were implemented over time to try to resolve some of the unique problems that were existing under the way the current base rate payment system that we have. So like the DRGs, yes. The eight or what, I can't remember how many, eight DRGs are special payment rates, and the rural I can't remember the
small
three things.
Rural.
Small rural payment was to recognize that this system is out of whack for some of our most rural providers. So I am concerned about that. And
we share
and I
that
need
concern.
To know how we can keep on top of this to make sure that what we design doesn't create a more serious problem than the one we've just fixed.
Madam Chair, one of the ideas that we've been talking about is should we have some type of report or study, some type of mechanism where the department gets back to us 6 months to a year from now to let us sort of look at what the impact of all these moving pieces has been, and we might have to make some adjustments in 2015 as well. So,
okay, thank you. And Senator Lori, you were looking like you wanted to say something about the Cheshire Cat there. So.
It's fine. One of the things that I do caution members, I don't assume that everybody's facilities come in and tell them that they're low-paid facilities. Some are, some aren't. But don't assume that your facilities are going to be the winners in this. It's very difficult to tell who's going to be a winner and who's going to be a loser. That's why the banding actually, can protect the whole industry. And the banding doesn't have to be done. I mean, hopefully we will have some additional information, as we proceed to understand how many, if we did the whole thing without any banding, how many would be losers, how many would be winners. We might be able to mitigate the losses and allow higher gains. These are some things that are in play. We're having very serious discussions, trying to get to the best place and really understand the effects of this. And I think the idea of coming back in a year or two is important. We absolutely have to get through this in order to be able to pay claims with the federal share of a Medicaid expenditure. So we have to institute something. And I think the banding concept, if we can get federal buy-in, is a good one. We're trying to narrow in on language on that.
Are you working on this with the stakeholders, Senator Lori?
I am.
Okay,
yes.
So we can credit you with this.
Madam Chair, just my closing comment. I know sometimes we feel like we're the victims and the department is doing something to us, and I just want to go on the record and say that the department has been very collaborative with us. They have been over to the Minnesota Hospital Association. A colleague of mine had a 2-hour conference call yesterday with the department. They are being very collaborative, and we are trying to get to a good position. I know Senator Lori has heard me say this. If we can get some additional resources into the budget neutral rebasing, it would help mitigate the impact to all of our members.
Yes,
so.
We hope that we could do something like that.
Thank you.
Great.
Go
ahead. No, it's okay, Senator Lori. Did you want to say something further? These committee members will not be in your committee, so if there's something you want to highlight.
Well, there's one other aspect that hasn't been talked about yet, and it's the certified public expenditure, IGT piece, that's also at play. And I know that the department is working very hard with those affected facilities as well. It hasn't really been highlighted just yet, but that changes in here and reflected in the language as well. and needs some work still as we move forward, too.
Okay, any questions? I just wanted to have this committee have a chance to really get what you're going to be talking about more. We didn't want to get into the weeds too much, but I think we were at a high enough level that people sort of grasped what we're struggling with. Thank you. Okay. Is there anything further, Senator Lurie?
I think those are the pieces that had the Health and Human Services.
Did we do Article 1? Did I miss that? Oh, the Department of Health.
The Department of Health. No, we haven't done the Department of Health yet. No, that's right, Madam Chair. And we haven't had Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry up for your question either.
To answer my question.
Yeah, she's been. Now we should expect a really good answer.
Yes, we gave her time.
It's not just right.
She's heard this question from me before a few times. So. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Your question was about, I think, the application of 245D or the new Rule 40 to all populations licensed by the commissioner. I think the first and important thing to remember is that Security Hospital and the Anoka Regional Treatment Center will not generally be subject to those changes in 245D, which I think is the concern that you have raised in the committee and in other places as well. For clients who are developmentally disabled and living in either of those two facilities, we will only be able to use manual restraints when there is an emergency and threat of imminent harm to self or others. But for all other populations, we intend to continue to use the tools that we have for restraint and seclusion when the client is a threat to either staff or other clients on the unit. So I don't know if that addresses your question.
Yes.
It's not
applicable. Could you describe manual restraints, what that means?
So it means, Madam Chair, it means that no other a restraint chair, no other mechanical devices can be used to restrain a person, that we could only use hands to restrain somebody.
So do you see that as a potential situation for injury?
Madam Chair, yes, that where we see most injuries, many injuries, is when restraints take place. At that point of restraint, there is lots of. It's why we want to move away from restraints when we can, because the more you restrain someone, the more likely that the person being restrained and the person who's doing the restraining are going to get hurt. So we start from a position that we want to move away from those things if we can. Manual restraint is certainly more dangerous to many populations, especially when you have a number of people who have to restrain one person at one time. It becomes very dangerous.
And I'm certainly aware of the need to not use restraints as a punishment or as a threat, which I think has been the impetus for much of the change here. There are bad actors out there that misused, for whatever reason, seclusion and restraint. But I wonder if you think that just a general work group or conversation around this subject, what we need to do to make certain that when someone is out of control, and in some of these places like Security Hospital, it isn't the typical client that's going to give you a lot of indicators up front. You might have just something that's absolutely unpredictable, like throwing oil on staff, which is one of the things that happens at Security Hospital that's unknown that's going to happen, hot boiling oil that has not been predictable. Even after you go through all those trainings to help, you know, what are the early symptoms or signs of increasing agitation and psychosis? So I just want to make sure that we have a place or an opportunity to sit down and say, what are we doing here that makes sense? That also takes into account the fact that if we go too far the other way, we're increasing our injuries, our workman's compensation costs, our patient injury costs, that we aren't going to that we aren't misapplying what we're talking about here to a situation that really needs us to be engaged in more supportive constraint for a person who's out of control.
Madam Chair, I think you did an excellent job of describing the balance that we need to strike when we talk about the different populations we've served. We clearly have agreed that for persons who are developmentally disabled, we won't use anything other than a manual restraint. But for other clients who are served in our facilities, both for their safety and their sake, when there is an imminent risk of threat of harm to themselves or to others, we need to use the other tools that we have, which include things like restraint chairs. And yes, we can train our staff, train our supervisors, train our managers. But for anyone who's ever worked on a unit, there are times when you are right, you cannot predict what is going to happen with a client. And we have to make sure that we protect the safety of everybody who's in that environment.
This is a tough subject, and I know this committee and others have been in some of the centers where we're dealing with the crisis units and admission units where people are really, really, their illness is at its most acute level. So their capacity to constrain themselves is gone. Mm-hmm. So you have to have external supports in order to keep them safe from themselves, from hurting other patients, or from hurting the staff. And I think that when we hear the stories about horrific treatment of vulnerable people with restraints or abandonment of people in seclusion for long periods of time, that our reaction to that is justified to be changing that. But we also have all of this data that's coming to us that shows us that we have to do something to create a more safe environment from those who are experiencing really, really acute stages of psychosis. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Madam Chair.
Appreciate it.
Need to talk about
what was left? Article 1?
There's one item that you had on your sheet here that I actually haven't been able to find in the bill, and that's the CARE deficiency funding, Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise, which is supposed to be an enterprise self-supporting fund, and it's run into a deficiency. That was on your sheet. Is that the one?
It might be Article 6, Section 1 that you're referring to.
Article 6, Section 1. And it allows for the department to seek federal approval to restructure the rate calculation around that and bring in additional funds and take care of a deficiency and the ability to continue to provide this level of care.
This is a chemical dependency treatment program that's been running a deficiency.
Okay.
And this is an effort to try to modify that and to get some more support for it to be able to continue to operate. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. All right. So now are we ready for Article 1?
Dave Greenman.
Madam Chair, Dave.
Hello, Mr. Greenman.
Hi. Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. Article 1 essentially creates an integrated system for providing oversight for home care providers who are licensed by the Health Department and home and community-based service providers who are licensed by the Department of Human Services. During the 2013 session, I should step back and say, home care providers have been licensed by the Health Department for a number of years. During the 2013 session, legislation was passed creating licensure for home and community-based services providers through DHS. That was effective, I think, January 1 of 14. Even though these two services sound like the same thing, they are actually they provide different levels of care, different types of treatment services, and are subject to different types of regulations. Without a change in law, however, there are about 200 providers in the state who deliver both home care services and home and community-based services. And without a change in the law, they would be subject to getting two different licenses from two different agencies. And so also during the 2013 session, the legislature directed both the health department and DHS to work together to develop an integrated system for licensing these providers so that they only need one license. And we were directed to come back with a report and recommendations in February of this year. This Article 1 is essentially the language in the proposal that was developed by the two agencies. Essentially what this would do is it would, effective July 1 of 2015, it would direct the Department of Health to begin, it would permit licensed home care providers who are licensed through the health department to also receive a home and community-based services designation also through the health department for providers who meet certain home and community-based services standards. This would essentially allow those providers to only work with one agency to get their certification for both types of services. It would be less expensive than getting both types of licenses and reduces the administrative burden for these providers. This does create standards and monitoring enforcement requirements for the department related to those providers who have the designation as well. And so that's essentially what this article does.
Is there someone else who wishes to testify?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring in the Health Department. And Dave Greenman did such a full and awesome job. I'm not sure I can really add, but I will be available for questions.
Oh, great. Thank you, Ms. Winkleman. Are there any questions from the committee on this article? I guess not. Thank you very much. I think that completes this the sections of this bill that are health policy. So, Senator Lori?
I'm struggling with this motion because I move Senate File 2754 as amended be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on
Finance.
HHS
Finance. Just Finance. Just Finance. That's correct. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you, Senator Lori. All righty. We're almost going to cross the finish line here.
We're not done?
All right, Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for hearing Senate File 133 again today. Since we last gathered to discuss this bill, Senate File 133 has traveled through the required committees. I made a commitment to you and to the committee that to meet with stakeholders and iron out as much agreement as possible and to bring clarity to the legislation. We have done this through numerous conversations and even a 1.5 to 2 hour meeting where all stakeholder groups were represented. Madam Chair, at this time, I'd like for someone to move my A9 amendment.
You can offer it.
I can.
Yes, you can.
Even though this is the second time in front of you, I will. Then I'm going to move the A9 amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Very good. Senator Hoffman, there are a couple of oral amendments to your amendment. We'll take input from Ms. Kavanaugh on that now.
Madam Chair and members, delete law 1.5. That shouldn't be there. And then we need to add on page 5, line 11 of the bill. Just add it to the amendment, but it's to the second engrossment, page 5, line 11, delete the and insert a.
You know, it's amazing. I don't know how these guys find this and come up with this in the amount of time. It's very impressive, isn't it? Really.
Or Madam Chair. Or Madam Chair, a little nerdy.
All righty. So let's take action first on the oral amendments. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. And now to the A9 amendment. Would you like to explain the amendment, or do you want us to pass it and then talk about all of what you've accomplished in this bill?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I'd like us to pass the A9 amendment, and I'll go through explaining a number of details, not to go longer than 2 hours.
2 hours. Perfect.
Okay,
perfect.
Thank you.
All right. Any questions on the A9 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, okay. Chair and members. Joining me at the table to assist in answering questions that you may have are Dr. Donna Spanish-Merton. She's got a PhD, MLS, and a professor of clinical laboratory science at the University of Minnesota. And Karen Renaud, who is MLS and manager of laboratory services at First Light Health Systems and past president of the Minnesota Society of American Society of Clinical Laboratory Science. Also later, Madam Chair, I believe that Tom Lehman would like to speak to this bill as well. So real quickly, Madam Chair, in our last hearing, there were three. Actually, there were four primary concerns that were of contention. Number one was the requirement of a four-year degree for a medical laboratory scientist. Number two was the military training being recognized and grandfathered in. Number three, the wave testing. And finally, number four, rural hospital accessibility. And so as you look at the A9, which was passed, the agreements represented in the A9 amendment are as follows. Well, we created a pathway to the MLS that did not require a four-year degree. That was huge. Most national certification exams require a degree, but not all. It is in that amendment. Number two, we dropped the specific military requirements and defaulted to the general requirements under this bill. This generally meets our intention, which was to conform with the VA standards. That is also in the amendment. Number three, we agreed to keep the provision that exempted wave testing. It remains in the bill. Number four, in addition to dropping the
requirement. Explain what wave, is it wave? Are you saying W-A-V-E?
Madam Chair, members, it's W-A-I-V-E.
Wave testing, and would you just explain what wave, did you wave?
It's like this kind of wave, not this kind of wave. What's
this?
So,
missed the spot, right?
Wave testing is
getting
what?
Punchy.
Really? Waving?
Hi, Madam Chair, Karen Renaud. Wave testing is a CLIA classification of testing that is considered so easily performed that it's not included in these, like the home pregnancy testing and things like that are waived testing.
And what are you doing about wave testing, Senator Hoffman, again?
We agreed to keep the provisions that exempted wave testing, so it remains in the bill.
And rural hospital access?
That was also covered as well, Madam Chair. In addition,
what was the issue about that, and what did you do to fix that?
The four-year, it really came from Senator Rosen's concern that by having these two distinctions, the four-year and the two-year, and by not having a grandfathering clause, by not dealing with the VA, that would have caused some rural hospitals not to have the access. The term was access, and so we cleaned that up in that two-hour meeting.
And added this.
And also, Madam Chair, if you look at the standardized for licensing starting at 1.33, those all covered those issues regarding rural access as well.
And
Madam Chair, if I can add one more, subdivision 3 starting at 2.32, the staff requirements covered that issue as well with the rural access.
All right. Any questions so far? This amendment is an effort to be responsive to the concerns that we wanted Senator Hoffman to address before it came back to this committee. So, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, I appreciate the accommodations you've made to ensure that we don't create a barrier for access. in across the state, but particularly in the rural areas. There's one concern that I had that I don't see addressed in the bill as amended, and perhaps you could address that. You know, it was this kind of a general concern about the fact that we are taking something that's regulated at the federal level, CLIA, and now we're imposing different state regulations on the same licensing and the same practitioners. And so we get in, and we do this sometimes in Minnesota. We do this in the financial services area, for example, too, where it gets very confusing and cumbersome. And when we have this two layers of bureaucracy or registration, I should say, so we have a federal level CLIA, and then we have this state level of registration or oversight, maybe that's not the right word, licensure as well. And so I'm just a little confused about how these different things are going to work together, and, you know, is it duplicative or are there differences, and what kinds of concerns is that going to cause?
Hi, Madam Chair and Committee. Karen
Renaud. Is it Ms. Renaud?
Yes, thanks. I think that the CLIA regulations actually is a certificate that the facility, the laboratory, has to follow, whereas the licensure bill is the practitioner. And so the licensure bill incorporates those CLIA regulations as best we can, but we feel it's not – the CLIA regulations are very little on personnel, and that's where the licensure is actually licensing the people, not the laboratory.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, just one final question. How does this type, Senator Hoffman, if this bill passes into law, how does this type of licensure compare with professionals in other states in the same field?
Ms. Renaud.
Madam Chair and Committee. There's 12 other states that have licensure currently. I think last count was around 20 other states that have it in proposing it in some fashion in state legislature. And what was the
question? Well, and then, Madam Chair, just
yes,
kind of
Senator
the final
Nelson.
Part of that question is, of those states that also have this type of licensure, how does what we're looking at here compare to those states? In other words, is it the same number of categories, same requirements, are they different? I don't expect a full-length thing, but maybe you could just tell me, are they similar, greatly different? Are we more stringent, less, that type of thing?
Yes, Ms. Renaud.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. I don't know the detail of other states' bills. Personally, I know many of the states all had a model bill. The American Society for Clinical Laboratory Science created a model licensure bill years ago that many states used to model. So there are definitely many similarities amongst the bills, but I do know there's also differences. But I don't know the detail. I'm sorry.
And one final comment, Madam Chair.
Did you want to respond to that as well, Senator Hoffman, before we go to the next question?
Madam Chair, I was just going to point out that conversation came up from Senator Benson, and we cleaned that. You know, if you look at lines 2.1 all the way down to 2.13, remember how it was really constricted to you must have this, you must have that, you must have. Well, now we created that or. And those were not all separate licensures. So this really cleaned up the language that is acceptable in most other states like that. So
thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Just my final comment. Thank you very much for cleaning this up, Senator Hoffman. And I guess just my final thought is that I think we have to be so careful that when we do things and we're well-intended, that we don't end up with some unintended consequences. And the one thing that I don't want to see here is have us have some type of licensure requirements, licensure designations that would either make our state more less business friendly. So in other words, labs would choose not to set up here and set up in other states. That would be of some disadvantage to the employees or the licensees, but I'm not sure that that would apply here. But mostly I just want to make sure that we're not doing something that would make it less likely that labs would choose to either retain, stay in Minnesota, or come to Minnesota.
Senator Hoffman, you mentioned a Dr. Merton that might want to testify.
Dr. Spanis Merton, she had to go. She got called away, but she really had addressed, you know, and I just can keep going, Madam Chair.
Senator Benson, do you have a question at this time?
May
have. No. Okay, continue.
I want to finish just my parts of my testimony, just so you can be very clear about, you know, how we got to this point, and it's a good bill. The Minnesota, there's very few bills where you get 100% a stakeholder, but this bill is no different. You guys will see a letter from the Minnesota Hospital Association. They distributed a letter in opposition to the bill, but I want to point out there were two points that are in there that the letter does acknowledge the resolution of their two major concerns that were originally stated, and that they were part of the two-hour conversation. And the issues that they listed in their other point of their letter were not brought up in that two-hour meeting. However, most of those were addressed in the A9 amendment. So we did address those issues by going in the A9 amendment. So most of that was addressed in that A9 amendment. So it's my understanding, Madam Chair, that also Tom Lehman, who was in opposition at the very beginning of this process, is here to speak on behalf of the bill as well.
Okay, thank you. We would invite other testifiers. Is there anyone who wants to testify? Mr. Lehman, are you hoping to testify?
We don't have any Democrats here.
I saw Mr. Moore there, too. Was he hoping to testify? Just there for answering questions, maybe?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Yep.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Lehman, appearing on behalf of the American Association of Bioanalysts. The summary that Senator Hoffman gave you just a moment ago was accurate. He committed to work with us, and at multiple times he hosted or convened discussions to try and resolve the differences here. The A9 amendment that you voted on a moment ago reflects the agreement that was reached in those discussions between the proponents and the American Association of Bioanalysts. Do we love this amendment? No, but as Senator Hoffman noted, when you try and reach to a compromise, everyone has to give. And I think both AAB and the proponents gave quite a bit to reach this compromise. And I just want to say the American Association of Bioanalysts appreciate Senator Hoffman's efforts as well as the efforts of the proponents to find a middle ground. And if I may, just a final comment, I've been lobbying up here 23 years and on a lot of contentious issues, and I've never dealt with a staffer who was more hardworking to try and find middle ground and a compromise. And I just want to acknowledge that Mr. Fleming from Senator Hoffman's staff was very hardworking and very dedicated to try and find something that was acceptable to both the American Association of Bioanalysts and the proponents, and I want to acknowledge that. So thank you, Senator Hoffman.
It's nice.
Great. And I see Mary Krinke in the back would like to also approach us. Is your assistant in the room, Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, he's in
the speaker. Then he heard the compliment. Okay.
He's hiding.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Mary Krinke, and I'm sorry to break up this positive sense that's going on with this bill. The Hospital Association still has concerns with the bill. After I got the amendment from Mr. Fleming, I took it back to our office, and I asked our patient safety folks there at the office to read the bill and the amendment and to look at it with trying not to have a bias whether or not they supported licensure or whether or not they did not support licensure, but to look at the bill and ask how they thought it would work in practicality. And a couple different examples that they provided that really, they asked me the question. They said, Mary, does this bill license every single employee who works in a hospital lab? And I said, I think that is the intention. And they said, well, it's one thing if you want a license to your people and you want a license for your people, but we have a lot of people who work in hospital labs who do what they call specimen preparation and transport. And I'll just give you an example. A lot of tests are done at the bedside in a hospital. We have very sick patients. A doctor or nurse takes a specimen. They take it over to the Hux desk, and they call down to the lab, and they say, can someone come up and get this specimen? So these are people who literally work in hospital labs who transport the specimen from one place in the hospital to another place in the hospital. So what this bill does, if you look at the language that was offered in the last paragraph, it says that the laboratory director can decide what type of license the employees have to have. So we have people who work in a hospital lab who do not need to be licensed. They are people who prep slides. They are people who prepare petri dishes. They are not doing the analysis, okay? So the way this bill is written, it requires everyone who works in a hospital lab to be licensed. On the opposite end of the spectrum, we have epidemiologists who are not licensed as doctors but have their PhD. And under this language, in order for an epidemiologist to work in a lab, they would either have to go back and get an MLS or an MLT degree. Now, we think that seems a little strange to have an epidemiologist have to become an MLT or an MLS. So there are some practical problems with how this bill is still being implemented. It is better than it was before. I do think it does address one of our concerns, which was that many of our rural hospitals only have two-year people, and it does not change their scope of practice. So in terms of where we are at, it is better than it was. I'm sorry to say the Hospital Association is still in opposition to the bill. So thank you for your consideration.
Ms. Krinke, where did you reference the place in the bill where the difficulty was occurring?
It is on page 4, line 4.29. It is called the histological preparation and the material derived from the human body. It's how do you prepare specimens and how they physically get transported within a hospital. So, and if you look at the new amendment that was offered, it is in the last paragraph on page 2, the staff requirements. In compliance with CLIA and applicable accreditation standards, employers and laboratory directors shall determine the appropriate license for staff. That implies to us that everyone who works in a hospital lab would have to have some type of license.
So the fix then is in that paragraph.
Well, the fix is not in that paragraph.
if there was language to be offered that would make certain that those particular functions were not required to be licensed, then that's where the fix would occur, according to what you're communicating?
Yes, Madam Chair, but I still go back fundamentally to sort of a bigger, broader question that I think Senator Nelson was sort of alluding to. We are still struggling with what problem is this bill really trying to address. We continue to believe our hospital labs are some of the best in the country, and we believe that inevitably this will add to costs.
Thank you. Ms. Krinke, I just want to summarize to make sure I have it that you did describe some very specific things that could be changed in language here, but even with that change, or any innumerable number of changes that would be placed in this bill, you would still be in the position that it's a problem that does not need a fix, something like that.
Madam Chair, that is the Hospital Association's position.
I'm only asking that because we can send Senator Hoffman off onto trying to solve a problem that's not fixable, and that's what I'm just trying to make clear here.
That is correct, Madam Chair. We do think that the word license in there does imply that all employees would have to be licensed if they work in a lab. So
I understood that, but you could fix that language.
Yes.
But and I thought you also said that wouldn't it would it's you would still remain unsupportive because you don't think it's a necessary
Correct.
Change. Yes. Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Shirley brought up those two issues at the very beginning, and we addressed those. But since we are on another one, I would like Ms. Renaud to help us come to the understanding of that the issue of what was brought up is actually embedded in this amendment.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you. Karen Renaud again. We did in the A9 amendment insert language in the exemptions that meets Ms. Krinke's needs there, I think. In line 1.16, we would exempt those that are solely involved in what we consider the pre-analytical and post-analytical phases of testing, which is what Ms. Krinke described as those that are drawing, processing, transporting specimens. That's not part of the test process itself. That specimen handling is exempt in this amendment.
And does that also relate to the epidemiologists?
There is an exemption currently in the bill, not even before the amendment, that exempts, I believe in Ms. Prinke's letter, it was described as conducting emerging diagnostic clinical tests, which would be, in my estimation, considered research testing, which is also exempt in the current bill.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on this bill, Senate File 133, as amended? And just give me a minute. My head just went blank here for a second.
Finance, Madam Chair.
Is there a motion here? It's to finance. Okay. Our motion for this would be that the committee pass Senate File 133 and it be referred to finance.
Thank you, Madam
as
Chair.
Amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my current understanding as well. So, as such.
On that motion, is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
It passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Hey, good timing.
Would you hold on here just a moment while I read a request that's in front of me? Senator Nelson, you have something that you wanted to communicate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I just wanted to recognize and introduce Civil Air Patrol Captain Parker Rosedahl, who is with us today. He's shadowing me. He's a student at RCTC, and it's always so wonderful when we get young folks up here who are monitoring and following their government, and so I just wanted to make sure that you had a chance to meet him. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Senator Nelson. Welcome, Captain Parker Rosedahl. Rosedahl, is that correct?
Yes, Rosedahl.
Great, and you have a great person to follow around today. So, okay, with that, we are actually adjourned. We'll see you. When will we see you again?
Monday at noon.
Monday at noon.